Welcome to the Word at First Pres. During Lent, we're doing a sermon series called Credo, the Apostles' Creed Then and Now. Each week, we will be examining a line from the Apostles' Creed and asking the question, what did this line of the creed mean to the people who wrote it, and what does it mean to us today? I hope you enjoy.
The first scripture reading is from Acts, verses 6 through 11 in the first chapter. So when they had come together, they asked him, Lord, is this the time when you will restore the kingdom to Israel? He replied, it is not for you to know the times or periods that the Father has set by his own authority. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. When he had said this, as they were watching, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. While he was going, and they were gazing up toward heaven, suddenly two men in white robes stood by them. They said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking up toward heaven? This Jesus, who has been taken up from you into heaven, will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
So our second scripture reading today is going to come from the Gospel of Matthew. It's going to be a continuation of this same theme, and we're doing from 16 and 25. For the Son of Man is to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay everyone for what has been done. Truly I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand, and the goats at the left. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So we are doing a sermon series. If you've been here, it's called Credo, the Apostles' Creed Then and Now. Each week we take a line from the creed and we ask the question, what did it mean to the people who wrote it and what does it mean to us today? And so each week we kind of start and we dive into the tradition. If you've been here, we'll dive into the scriptures surrounding that. And then from there, we will kind of ask, what's a modern interpretation of this? Because for a lot of us, our worldview has been influenced by science and technology. And therefore, it's kind of hard to blend these two things together sometimes. But the goal is to show you that whether you agree with the traditional interpretation or the modern interpretation, that the Apostles' Creed has the flexibility to speak to both audiences. Yes? We on the same page? Yeah. All right. So do you remember what we did last week? We did that he, on the third day, right, he will rise from the dead. And then he will come again. And we talked about the resurrection and the ascension. We're going to move on from that to the next part of it, which is he sitteth at the right hand of God the Father Almighty, and he will come to judge the living and the dead. So we're actually not going to focus so much on the first part of that. That actually refers to the concept of Trinity. We actually talked about that a couple of weeks ago, so we're going to kind of forego that one. But we are going to be focusing on the second part of this today, which is essentially the idea of Jesus' second coming, that he's going to come back at some point, and he's going to judge all humanity for their deeds. Now, I actually find this part of the creed, I actually think this is one of the most brilliant lines in all of the creed. Because whether you realize it or not, it's doing something very inventive. If you look at everything we've talked about up until this point, it's all in the past. It's all things that have happened like thousands of years ago. But this is where it transitions us into the present and in the future. And it's actually laying out for us a roadmap of what the future is supposed to look like. And in order to go back into this, I want to go back to what we heard Laura read from Acts real quick, because this is going to kind of set the stage for us. Let's take a look at this one more time. So as they were watching, Jesus was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. Suddenly, two men in white robes stood by them, and they said, This Jesus, who has been taken up from you into heaven, will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. So This is referring to Jesus's what we call the second coming, right? That Jesus is going to return. So he goes up into heaven, he disappears, and they're saying, okay, this is the way he's going to come back. Now, what you have to appreciate is that for the earliest Christians, this was a very closely held belief that they had. They believed that Jesus was going to come back literally at any moment. It wasn't like a year or a decade, like tomorrow. He's going to be back tomorrow. And this was a huge point of anxiety for the people who were early Christians, because Jesus' return was associated with some very uncomfortable events. So the first thing that happened when Jesus returns is that it triggers what's known as the eschaton, which is a big fancy word, which basically means the entire earth is just blown apart. Like, it's all taken out, it's all burned up, all the nations of the world are collapsed into each other. And after the eschaton begins, once all the nations are kind of gone, the next thing that happens is it triggers what we call the resurrection of the dead. So literally, every human that has ever been on the earth will be brought back to life, and they will be given a new human form. Now, I didn't say this last week. If you were here last week, you heard me talk about Jesus's resurrection. And I gave you the three options of the way that it works, right? This, the spirit ghost version, the bodily version, and then the vision version of resurrection. What I didn't say, and I should have said it, was that the Apostles' Creed comes down pretty hard on the side of bodily resurrection. Like, that's where it is for them, and that's where it states that is going to happen. But what's interesting is, if you look at science, do you know how many humans have ever existed on the earth? Like, generally speaking, if you look at all of human history, 100 billion people have existed in that time. So, if we're just going to put it out there, there's how many people on the earth right now? 8 billion, and we're pretty crowded. So, if 100 billion people, just imagine, we're going to be stacked up like Lego bricks when everybody comes back. So, it's going to be a lot of folks. So, Jesus, we have the resurrection. People come back, right? Everybody's here, and then what happens is Jesus is established as the new king of this nation. And the nation, by the way, is the entire world. All the other nations, they're gone. He is the king of this nation. It's centered in Jerusalem. That's where it's based out of. And then from there, he's going to start. The first thing he has to do is he has to start judging everyone for what they've done. And that judgment, by the way, just so we're clear, he's going to shutter you into one of two categories. So you're either going to end up being a sheep or a goat, right? Now, the sheep, if you're a sheep, that means you get to be with Jesus in his kingdom for all eternity. If you're a goat, you're going to be in a lake of sulfur for all eternity. On par, it's probably better to be a sheep. I'm just going to put that out there. Generally speaking, probably want to aim for that. However, with 100 billion people, and assuming he's starting at the beginning with like Adam and Eve, and he's got to do everybody individually, we're way at the back of the line. So it's going to take a long time, right? Like, you're going to be waiting. Like, even if you're a goat, you don't really need to worry about it. Like, it's going to be a while before he gets to you. So, as brilliant as this line is, the truth is that this whole idea, if we're being honest, is hard for modern people to get their minds around. Would you agree with that? Like this is definitely in the scriptures, but it can be very hard for people. And in fact, there was a Pew Research study that was done where they asked people, they said, do you believe in Jesus' second coming? And this is among Americans. And 45% dismissed it as being implausible. Now, what's not going to surprise you is that exact same number of people said they didn't believe in Jesus' resurrection. And those two things kind of go together, right? Like, you're not going to believe in the second coming if you didn't believe in Jesus' resurrection. So a lot of people, I mean, almost half of Americans say they don't believe in this. But what's interesting is that, okay, you can dismiss this idea if you want, but it's actually getting at something that's universally important to all of us, which is, who's going to hold us accountable for our actions? Because the truth is that the vast majority of people in the world are not held accountable. Like, it's a very small minority of people who actually face justice for the things they've done wrong, for their mistakes. The rest of us, we just walk away scot-free, and we don't ever face any consequences for it. So I'm gonna show you, I'm gonna illustrate this to you, I'm gonna show you a clip from a documentary. that I saw a long time ago. It's called Auschwitz, Inside the Nazi State. And you're going to be hearing from two people in this. The first person you're going to hear from is a Nazi guard who was inside of Auschwitz, and he's going to tell you about some of the things that he did while he was there. The second person you're going to hear from is a Holocaust survivor. And that Holocaust survivor is going to tell you about a time he was on a train transport with other prisoners going from one place to another. And that's going to set the foundation for the rest of what we're going to talk about today. So let's listen.
Try to imagine there is a ditch with people on one side and behind them soldiers. That was us, and we were shooting. And those who were hit fell down into the ditch.
Das, was Sie, während Sie geschossen haben, gedacht.
Could you tell me what you were thinking and feeling when you were shooting?
Nothing. I only thought, aim carefully, so that you hit properly. That was my thought.
This was your only thought. During all that time, you had no feelings for the people, the Jewish civilians that you shot.
No.
And why not?
Und warum nicht?
Because my hatred towards the Jews is too great. And I admit my thinking on this point is unjust. I admit this. But what I experienced from my earliest youth, when I was living on a farm, what the Jews were doing to us, well, that will never change. That is my unshakable conviction.
As he grew up in the 1930s in an atmosphere of vicious anti-Semitism, Hans Friedrich came to believe that local Jewish traders had cheated him and his family.
What in God's name did the people you shot have to do with those people who supposedly treated you badly at home? They simply belonged to the same group. What else? What else did they have to do with it?
Nothing. But to us, they were Jews.
All the wagons was very packed. One guy was up. And he was German. He told us he was German. Who knows, maybe a convict, who knows. And he wanted to sit down. He couldn't stand up no more, this guy. So, and he told me, I got some cigarettes. Would you let me sit down? When I had cigarettes, you know that. When I had some cigarettes, he gave me 2-3 cigarettes. I got up and he sat. So the cigarettes in 5-10 minutes were gone. We told him, get up. Get up. Stand up. He won't stand up. So what I did was, me and a couple more friends, we sit on him. In about 30 minutes, 1 hour, he was suffocated, that guy, and we threw it out of the wagon. I was happy. How did I feel? They killed all my family, about 30, 40 people of my family, and I killed one German? That was nothing.
It was a murder, wasn't it? You did murder a fellow prisoner.
I was happy at the time, I told you, because it was German. I won't do that to one of ours. But anyway, I wanted to be seated too over there because I got tired too. Why he should leave? Because he gave me 2-3 cigarettes. That's why he didn't want to get up, so we sit on him and he passed away. Easy.
So I think that what I'm gonna take both of these stories and I wanna break them down for a bit. So in both instances, both of these men are responsible for murder. Yes? Okay. Circumstances are different. Okay, so you have the Nazi guard. He ends up, he's instructed by his superiors to kill Jewish prisoners, and he does so. We have the Holocaust survivor, and he decides that he's going to sit on this German prisoner, and he's going to suffocate him to death. Now, neither of these men, would you agree, show any remorse for what they did? Like, zero remorse for what they did. And they both have different justifications for why they did it. So, the, you know, when you talk to about that Nazi guard, he said, well, they were Jewish traitors that defrauded my family. I don't see any problem with that. And then you have the Holocaust survivor who sat there and he said, well, they killed 30 or 40 members of my family. What's one German prisoner, right? I was happy to do it. Now, just to be clear, neither of these men ever faced a trial for what they did. Neither of these men ever faced justice. They just, after the war was over, they went about their lives without facing any severe consequences from the criminal justice system for what occurred. And by the way, these two men, they're just a drop in the bucket. Like when we're talking about this situation, we're talking about murder, genocide, rape, torture, slavery. We're talking about physical, psychological abuse. When you're looking at things like terrorism or the abuse of animals, like way, way, way more people have done those things and have gotten away with those things than have been caught and have served time for those things. Like way more people. In fact, as we're sitting here, literally right now, over in Ukraine, there are war crimes being committed, right as we speak. 99% of those people will never face any justice for what they've done. You might have heard, did you hear over the weekend that Vladimir Putin, that he was charged with crimes against humanity? Now that's mostly symbolic, right? Because the likelihood of him ever facing any actual time for that or even going to trial is very, very slim. But we did it anyway. And so I think this is why, for a lot of people, we look to the afterlife to balance the scales. I think that we hope that because there's so little justice in this life, that God is going to make things right in the afterlife. And I think this is why a lot of people, a lot of religious people, want to believe in a hell. Like, we want to believe that God is going to take things and make things right. That people who cause suffering, that they will one day suffer themselves. And I'll admit to you, when I watched that documentary and that Nazi guard came up, I'm like, yeah, there's a part of me that's like, yeah, I'm looking forward to a day when that guy, right, when he's going to face judgment for what he's done. And yeah, it wouldn't be so bad if he burned in hell for at least a little while, right? So, like, that's kind of like my take on that. But then we get to that Holocaust survivor. I don't know if you're anything like me, but you sit there and you say, well, he murdered too. But there's a part of me that feels like, well, should he face the same punishment? I mean, shouldn't he be given kind of a little bit of a different standard? I mean, this guy was, what? He was part of one of the greatest genocides in the history of the world? Now, I don't know if you're on the same page with me on that, but that's kind of how I approach both of those situations. The question is, why do we feel that there's a difference? And I assume that you're probably with me on that. There probably does feel like a little bit of a difference between the two things. Yes? No? I mean, there feels like a difference. Why is there a difference? There's a difference because the circumstances are different, right, between those two people. And so the question becomes, should we take the circumstances of our lives into account when we're being judged? Should God take those circumstances into account? This is the question that I want to pose to you this morning. And there's two ways that you can deal with this. The first way is that you can say, well, a crime is a crime. Like, we look at the crime in isolation. Murder is murder, right? So if you murder somebody, you face the consequences for it. And this way of looking at it basically says, we're looking at the crime in isolation, and we're saying that the crime matters more than the circumstances that produce that crime. And by the way, that's kind of the way the criminal justice system works right now. That's the way our criminal justice system works. It's the way the Bible works, right? You look in the Old Testament. What does it say in the Old Testament? You do this, this is the punishment. right? Doesn't matter why you did it, it's just this and this. And that tends to be the way our criminal justice system works. We do sometimes take into account circumstances, but it doesn't matter as much. The second way that you can do this is that you can take into account a person's circumstances for why they did things. So if we did that, we would sit there and we would say, okay, let's look at that Nazi soldier and ask, why did he do that? Well, he grew up in an era where there was rampant anti-Semitism. He was taught as he grew up that the Jews were responsible for every wrong that had happened to Germany since World War I and before. And therefore, even though he was misinformed, that he made, that he believed that these were the enemy, that the Jews were the enemy. And so when he's killing those Jewish prisoners, what does he believe? He's killing the enemy. That's how he was thinking at that time. The same thing could be done for those, for the Holocaust survivor, right? The Holocaust survivor, he is in a situation where not only did they kill 30 to 40 members of his family, but he himself was a prisoner in the Holocaust. Like, literally, this man, it's not like he had a good time with all this. Like, he was beaten, he was starved, he was tortured. Like, these are things that he personally went through. So when he kills one German prisoner, to him, right, what is he doing? Is he killing the enemy? Absolutely he is. He believes that. Both men believe this is the case. Now, when you do this, when you take those circumstances into account, it kind of changes it, right? Because all of a sudden you're seeing, okay, it doesn't excuse what they did, but it helps you to understand why they made the decisions they made. It makes it a little bit less black and white. Would you agree with that? All right, so you have option one, option two. Depending on, I actually believe, what I seem to see, is that whether you're going to go with option one or option two, it tends to be about the type of God you believe in. So if you believe in a God of conditional love, meaning there's conditions around your forgiveness, you're going to tend to go with option one. If you believe in a God of unconditional love, where you're going to take, then you're probably going to go with option two, taking into account the circumstances. Neither of these are great options, by the way. I want to tell you why neither of these act, because they both have problems with them, and I want to walk you through those problems. So let's go with option one first. Okay, option one is the God of conditional love. So as I told you, right, the God of conditional love basically says that we're not going to take into account the circumstances. The crime is the crime, and if you do something wrong, you're going to pay a penalty for it, right? That's the way it works. So that tends to be, if that's kind of your perspective, that's the way it goes. Now, there is a loophole in this, and the loophole is that if you believe in Jesus, because this is traditional Christian thinking, if you believe in Jesus, then you are forgiven of your sins. So given that way of thinking, if that German Nazi soldier, if he believed in Jesus and accepted Jesus into his heart, then ultimately at judgment, he would be forgiven for what he did wrong. And he would be let go. Vice versa, the Holocaust survivor who is Jewish and who does not believe in Jesus, even though he survived one of the worst genocides in the history of the world, this guy, he would actually not be forgiven and that he would have to burn in hell. That would be the idea behind that. So that's option one, and it does come with a loophole. All right, so I'm not super comfortable with that logic. I'm just going to be honest with you. That I don't feel good about that. So I tend to go with option two. So option two is we have this God of unconditional love, and that God takes into account circumstances. So the reason why this is important is because human beings, when we make decisions, we never make a decision without the prior events that caused that decision. Like, you can never make a decision in a vacuum as a human being. You're always going to make decisions based on your prior understanding of the world, even if it's super skewed, right? Like, as we saw in the video, their understanding of the world at that time was super skewed in both directions. And so I would like to believe that God will take that into account, understanding this is why you made those decisions, given that that was like very extreme, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Now, I would even take it one step further than that. I would say that because our decisions as human beings are inextricably linked with our environment and our circumstances, you can't ever really separate those two things. I believe that ultimately every sin that we commit will be forgiven down the road. Now, that is a problem also, isn't it? Because what that means is that Nazi soldier who we've been talking about, that guy will ultimately be forgiven for what he did, whether or not he shows remorse, which I totally get feels very unfair. Like, that doesn't feel right, right? Like, you can basically do whatever you want, and you can just get away with it. In the end, you're going to be forgiven. So, and this is what I believe. I actually totally believe that. But I see the problem, and I don't really like it either. Like, there's a part of me that's like, no, I don't know. I don't feel good about it. So we have these two options, and neither of them feel very satisfying. Would you agree? All right. So we also have another problem with this. And the other problem is that we don't know what happens when we die. Like, we could be wrong about this. We don't know if there is an afterlife. In fact, there's a lot of people today who don't believe in an afterlife. So you sit there and you tell them Jesus is coming back, or that there's going to be a resurrection, or that there's even going to be a judgment, and they're like, nah, not going to happen. Or they're not worried about it. So really, this becomes all there is. And there's truth to that. We don't know what's going to happen when we die. So it very well could be that this is all there is, and this is our one shot at it. But there is some evidence to suggest that this is not all there is. Because we do have instances of people who die for very short periods of time, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, sometimes a little bit longer, and they come back. And it's happened a lot in the last 60 years, right? Because our medical technology has improved where we can bring people back. And they have what's called a near-death experience, or an NDE. Now, people who have these near-death experiences, not everybody, by the way, who dies for short periods of time has these, but for those who have them, there are 16 traits that we found. There's a guy, he's a psychiatrist, his name's Bruce Grayson, he's studied these, and not everybody has all the same traits, but it's very interesting. What generally happens is that if you're going to have a near-death experience, the first thing that happens is you have an out-of-body experience. So you die, and you see yourself, and you realize, uh-oh, I am no longer alive. And that's where most people's near-death experiences stop. They don't go much further than that. That's the vast majority of people. But for a subset of those people, there are some people who they can go around, they do all these things, and then all of a sudden there's a tunnel of light that they see, and they go through this tunnel of light, and they end up on the other side in a heavenly realm. And there, they often interact with dead family members, they will see angelic beings, and oftentimes they see what they call the being of light, which most people interpret to be God. Now, for those who have been through this experience, they often talk about it as one of the most transformative experiences of their lives. People who come back from that are often quite changed as a result of their time there. Now, why have I told you this? Like, why does this matter in terms of what are we talking about today? Because of the people who go to the heavenly realm, there is a subset of those people who have what is called a life review process. And the life review is they get up and they're standing there in the heavenly realm and they see literally their life flash before their eyes. And they talk, the way they describe it is that they see these scenes from their lives and they all kind of like mix and mesh together. And they're kind of watching them occur, kind of like it's watching television in some ways, except that it's much more visceral and real because they can feel what they felt in the moment, and they can also feel what the other person was feeling when that event happened. So in many ways, they say that it feels more real than when they experienced it the first time around. Now, I want you to imagine that for a moment. Imagine that you are that Nazi guard. What would that be like for you? You have to now relive murdering those people. And this time, not only do you feel what you felt, which he said was nothing, but now you are feeling the fear and you are feeling the pain that those people went through. And so you're reliving that. Same thing with that Holocaust survivor. What is he doing? He has to relive suffocating that German prisoner, sitting on him, the anguish that that man went through. And what's interesting about all of this is that when they talk about these things that occur, like when they actually talk about this moment, when they're watching all of this happen, The being of light is often in the background there. And what they describe is that they don't ever feel any judgment from the being of light. Do you know where they feel judgment from? Themselves. Because as they're watching this unfold and they're feeling all these things, they're watching what they've done, they're feeling this, they're feeling the weight of this on their shoulders. They're feeling the anguish, they're feeling the pain, they're feeling the hurt that they caused. And what they talk about is how, as they're watching this happen, they feel worse and worse and worse. They feel almost crushed by the things that they've seen, the things that they've done, the ways that they've hurt people. And then, just when they feel like they're the worst creature in the history of the universe, that's when the being of light comes in and envelops them in unconditional love. And that's when all of that self-hatred gets washed away and they feel like everything's going to be okay. Now, I don't know if those NDEs are real. Like, we don't know. I can't prove those to you. These are people's experiences. I don't know what to say to that. But there's some very interesting things about that that I like. One, when these events happen, they happen across ethnicities, cultures, religion, and they happen the same way across all of those things. It doesn't matter whether you're here in the United States or over in China, when people have them, it's very, very similar. The second thing is that it reaffirms my belief in a God of unconditional love. Because, yes, Jesus tells us that there's a God of unconditional love, but these people from all these different cultures who encounter this being of light, they always talk about a God of unconditional love. And so for me, I sit there and I ask the question, okay, it seems like we have a lot of things lining up. Is there going to be a judgment? Well, it seems like yes, there will be a judgment. But the beauty of that judgment isn't that God is going to judge you. It's that, ironically, God has handed you that responsibility to judge yourself. And so this is how I want to end this morning. I want to end with a plea to you to be kind. Because at some point, if what we're talking about here is true, you're going to re-experience every single moment of your life. And you're going to have to experience every time you cause pain to another person. So if that's not incentive to be kind and good and loving, I don't know what is. Because I can tell you, I look back at my life and I've made a lot of mistakes and I've hurt a lot of people in my time. But going forward, I know that I have a choice to be different. And this is why, a big reason why, underneath that choose love, be the light, change the world, that's every moment you do that means it's another moment where you have an opportunity where you'll look back on your life and say, I made a difference. I chose to do something different. I may have hurt somebody here, but from that point forward, I was better. And my friends, if you do that going forward, if you are always making that choice to be kind and generous and loving and giving, then you can change the world. And when you have that moment of judgment, you're going to look back and say, I didn't do so bad. Amen.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to learn more about First Presbyterian Church of Arlington Heights, please visit www.firstpresah.org for more information on service times, directions, and to learn more about the First Pres family of faith.